time to begin. We have our third session in our meeting today, and this will go until 3 o'clock. Session 3 deals with relationships with private research sponsors and best licensing practices. Committee member Craig Alexander, who's vice president and general counsel with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, will be the moderator and leader of this panel. Thanks, Craig.
Thank you, Mark. So I want to thank our distinguished panelists who've agreed to be here today and for your time and your energies. We got together by phone once, but we, I think, had a very good session. And like Wes did earlier today, I'm not necessarily going to address all of the discussion questions that are listed in your agenda. And for some of them, we may not address them exactly the form. But the gist of what's there is what we'll be covering. I'd like to start by asking each of our panelists to introduce him or herself with a little brief statement of who you are and why you're here, what your interest is in this topic, and any other remarks you want to make to kick us off here. So why don't we start at the other end of the table from me. Is that okay, Diana? I didn't really give you any heads up. You don't have to say anything, any kickoff statement if you don't want. We'll get into it soon. So, Diana Wetmore.
Thank you. First, I would like to thank Guru and the organizers and our chairman for this opportunity. It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm supposed to, in 3 minutes, give you an idea of why I sit here. My name is Diana Wetmore. I am the Vice President of Alliance Management at Cystic Fibrosis Foundation Therapeutics, which is a wholly owned, not-for-profit subsidiary of Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. My background is a PhD in biochemistry. I sort of have a foot in science and a foot in business. I'm responsible for the intellectual property position with our organization. So our mission is to find the means to cure and control the disease of cystic fibrosis. The activities that we undertake to cover that mission have a wide range, including the funding of CF clinical care centers, standard of care consensus meetings, and quality improvement. That is for enabling physicians and the patients themselves to work out standards of care to make the most of existing therapies. But probably what we're most well known for in your circles would be our investments in discovery and development projects. We invest in both industry and academic sectors. We also fund basic research. We fund basic research that is geared towards a better understanding of the disease and to support and accelerate the mission. And herein lies my interest in intellectual property for this August body. I thought of 3 IP issues, I would just say, as an example of the kinds of things that we deal with. The first is terms and conditions of the grants that we award to university researchers. And those grants might be for very basic research, not anticipated to generate intellectual property, but they might be very specifically geared towards developing tools and compounds that will enable our mission directly. So we have an interest in making sure that those terms and conditions are appropriate for both the awardee and for ourselves. The second thing is that we are looking for a streamlined and reasonable licensing process for supporting our industry projects. So we'll try to help and facilitate a shortened, or at least reasonably short, discussion around what the licensing terms ought to be for companies where we're supporting 100% of the discovery. And the other thing that we're looking at that may be of interest to this panel is we are looking at creative ways of putting together research consortia. And those may be consortia of academic researchers or of academic and industry, where we're underwriting a lot of the research. And our idea is to create upfront agreements about how the intellectual property will be managed. These are out of cycle and less rigorous review process type grants, and so what we hope for in return is ready access to technology and information for those engaged in drug discovery and development for cystic fibrosis.
That's great. Thank you, Diana. And we'll just move my direction then. We then have, Alan
Porson,
who is here from the Glaucoma Research Foundation.
Alan. Thank you. I am the Director of Scientific Programs and Licensing at Glaucoma Research Foundation. And glaucoma is the leading cause of irreversible blindness in the world. About 70 million people have the disease. It's a neurodegenerative disease, so it is, over the past decade, has been understood to be linked with the same molecular processes as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Huntington's, Lou Gehrig's disease. Our goal is to find a cure, so that means our goal is to go out of business, which is different from every other job that I've had. We do directed research. My position is a new position. It's been created, and I've joined within the past year, where we have an in-house scientist who is in charge of ferreting out the most productive areas, or at least guesses at them, and try to steer the advisory committee, the scientific advisory committees that we have. So we're trying to get on top of that. It's the older model. I won't say older model, but another model where you get requests for proposals. You choose a few. You hope that they do well, and then they walk away. Well, we have a different view. We have a collaborative. A major funding is directed in a collaborative way where we have four principal investigators, each with different skills, and we fund them in three-year phases and do reviews, as you say, out of cycle, less overhead, hopefully. And we, as part of that, have an intellectual property program that we're keeping in place, which does upfront determine what all the aspects of the intellectual property will be. And so we're getting in front of it in that we're doing these agreements. They're a lot easier to do before there's any value. And we're early stage, I would say, in our investments. We're before any other funding agency would come in. We have a number of grants that have been obtained through the research results that we've funded. So we're really sort of a Kickstarter. You heard in the first session today about how the seed stage money has dropped off dramatically. I think the word was dropped off like a cliff, and that's true. And so we have stepped in, and we view that we are a replacement for that. And I think everyone who's in the foundation world, and I'll say it maybe first, but we're the patient's advocates. So there's industry that is out there. There are the physicians who are out there, and there isn't, except for foundations, and I put it up for your insights, but except for patients, it's the foundations that want to say, hey, you know, the status quo isn't really working for me, but I'm one person. And so I look at it as if I'm helping the everyone afflicted with glaucoma. And if we can put some progress into Huntington's, that's great too.
Thank you, Alan. And then a third representative from a organization that funds not-for-profit organization that funds particular focused research is Louise Perkins from the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation.
It is a mouthful.
It is. MMRF.
MMRF. It's much easier to say. So I'm Louise Perkins. Let me tell you a little bit about my background, which is very much in alignment with what the MMRF undertakes. And then I'll speak to the organization, a little bit about our history and what we fund. And I think when you hear about the kinds of organizations that we fund, you'll get an idea of why I'm here today. My own background is that I have 16 years of industry experience doing small molecule drug discovery with two different pharmaceutical companies, ranging from target identification and validation through to presenting candidates for clinical testing. I was with both Shearing Plough and Bayer Pharmaceuticals, and interestingly, when I joined Bayer, I actually joined to do research licensing, to work closely with technology transfer offices to bring research, in particular research tools, into the pharmaceutical group that I worked for, and I supported the cancer research group at the time, to allow us to do our research better. About a year and a half ago, I found myself in the position of looking for something different to do, not least of which because the Bayer research group was disbanded in West Haven. But at the time was presented with the opportunity to come to the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation. Myeloma is a disease of the blood. It's a relatively little-known blood cancer. There are 65,000 people living with myeloma in the U.S., 19,000 diagnosed annually at this point in time. And what I found when I interviewed at the MMRF was that through the efforts of our founder and CEO, Kathy Giusti, who is herself a patient with the disease, but also a pharmaceutical executive by training, someone with a Harvard MBA, who created the foundation in 1998, I had found that she put in place essentially a company able to reap the benefits and work in partnership with a number of institutions, both academic and pharmaceutical and biotechnology, to really meet our mission, which is to accelerate the pace of development of treatments for patients with myeloma. The MMRF funds research in three main areas, basic science, translational research, and clinical research. And we do that in a number of different ways. One of which is academic grants, grants to academic centers that are either unfocused, you know, bring us your great ideas, or that are focused. And so to one of the comments that I'd made earlier, we do influence the direction of research and the outcomes of research by funding focused RFAs. In the translational research area, we have undertaken grants to academic centers to evaluate certain compounds that we think are of interest to determine if they should be prioritized for bringing forward in myeloma. We are also getting into the business of trying to contract more of that research so that we can get things done that academic folks really are not interested in working on or wired to work on. And then on the clinical side, our sister organization, the Multiple Myeloma Research Consortium, is founded around tissue banking and clinical testing. We have a large tissue bank which houses around 2,000 samples, purified patient tumor cells, and matched peripheral blood samples, which we hope to use to increase the pace of research into the disease. But I would say more importantly, our consortium, which comprises 15 academic sites, exists to integrate and coordinate the efforts of these academic centers, which are essentially the sole source provider of clinical testing for oncology academic centers, that is, and to try to bring some more sense and overcome some barriers there. We've entered into a number of agreements with these centers to reduce barriers and to speed moving forward on clinical trial agreements to address issues like intellectual property. We also fund for-profit companies to bring them into the area of myeloma, recognizing that it is an orphan disease and not everyone is going to want to play there. And so we make spot funding investments to get them interested in and to get bring them into our field where we think it's appropriate. We owe much of our research direction to the great efforts of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, who have really pioneered a lot of this work and been very grateful with their information sharing to us. So I just want to leave you with a visual. When organizations like ours are advocating on behalf of patients, and in our area in particular, I told you about how many patients are diagnosed every year, how many are living with the disease. What I didn't mention is that 32 patients die every day from myeloma. And so imagine that everyone in these chairs is gone in 2 days because a contract sat on somebody's desk, because we can't reach an agreement on intellectual property. Those are the kinds of delays we really want to avoid because it's just wasteful in more ways than one.
That's a sobering way to, but an important way to put an emphasis on what we're here to talk about today. And finally, the fourth member of our panel is Arvid Sidonis, who is a professor, assistant professor in the School of Business, the Stephen Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan.
Thanks, Steve, for inviting me to be part of this panel. Yes, as a professor in the business school, I seem to spend most of my time nowadays teaching strategy to MBAs. So it's nice to be discussing a topic that's a little bit closer to my research interests, the University Research and Commercialization. My background, I published a book along with Bhavan Sampath, who's stepped out, I think, or maybe he's back there in the corner, David Mowry and Dick Nelson on university industry relations and how those changed in the last 100 years, and we try to put the Bayh-Dole Act in that perspective. In terms of sponsored research, which is what we're talking about today, I started collecting some data on sponsored research agreements at the University of Michigan. Unfortunately, I don't have enough, I haven't gotten far enough along to actually present any findings or any results to you today. But I would like to mention there is one study by Janet Berkowitz and Beverly Tyler of sponsored research agreements where they looked at 136 agreements at a major conference call before this panel, and I think some of those issues were mirrored in our conference call. There was concern by the foundations, that, the way I heard it, over the availability of research results and research materials in dealing with the universities, sponsoring research in universities. And also, I heard there was concern about participation by the sponsors in terms of control over the IP and participation in the licensing revenue. So I think those are the issues I'm sure that will be coming up in our discussion. To my knowledge, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, and we heard a lot of anecdotal evidence today on the earlier panels, but not a lot of large sample studies covering these issues. So, Beverly Tyler and Janet Berkovitz is one as one. I have collected some data on MTAs, which is also related or pertains to access to research materials, material transfer agreements, and a descriptive study that David Mowry and I published a little while ago, we found that the existence of MTAs did not seem to impede commercialization or access by researchers of the inventions covered by the MTA. We're also doing some research right now at material transfer agreements at the University of California, and in terms of incoming MTAs, so materials coming into the university, we're finding that the nonprofits are much better. Much easier for the university to deal with, and they're able to negotiate these agreements much more quickly and bring the materials into the university researchers pretty quickly compared to the private sector agreements, which tend to be more complex and take longer. So, that's not exactly what we're talking about here, but I mean, it does pertain to access to research results, and I think MTAs do fold into sponsored research agreements often.
So I guess I should say a word or two about why am I the moderator here. So I am a lawyer, and lawyers took some criticism this morning, and I think a lot of that is probably well-deserved. And I think that, I'm in an organization that does research, and we do it at 70-some different research universities and research institutions throughout the U.S., and that gives me an interesting perspective on how the tech transfer offices, how the sponsored research offices of all these places work, and how they sometimes don't work as well as perhaps we'd like for them to, how my own staff either helps or hinders handling of materials transfers or deals with licenses, and how we sometimes need to nudge our scientists to send out their materials or help them when they have a colleague who isn't sending them materials. And so I bring a perspective where, and as a lawyer, I also can see on the one hand the what seems to me to be a lot of effort on things that, a lot of legal effort, a lot of focus on terms, on things that don't ever really amount to much, and yet the impact of that is to slow things down and to frustrate and probably keep some research from happening. At the same time, I'm also a lawyer for an organization that worries about, just as most organizations do, well, what happens if you didn't pay attention or didn't take care of this term or that term, and then something bad happens or something good happens that you didn't share in. And so I think that these are all very important questions, some of which I hopefully will get to, some of which were touched upon already earlier today. So I'd like to start, and hopefully this will sound familiar to my panelists, with a basic question. This will be focused probably more directly to the three of you from the organizations that fund research. But what are your organization's primary interests when you're initiating and negotiating the terms of a sponsored research agreement where you'll be funding research at a university? What are the things that are most important to you? We went through some of these in sort of different cuts at them in our conference call, but I thought maybe we could pull them together this way, and we can start with whomever, or I'll call on one of you if you don't start. So, Louise, would you like
to? I can start.
Sure.
So if, in the case of funding sponsored research at an academic institution, I would say first and foremost, we want to be sure, as was discussed earlier, that the product of that research is available for non-commercial research purposes. And I think what strikes me as being surprising is the academic institutions that I actually get pushback from on that, that they don't want to guarantee those terms. That one is always confusing to me. That I will say that tends to be the exception. We also want to be sure that if inventions arise from the sponsored work, that those inventions are protected, because we do feel that in order for most inventions, in particular in the pharmaceutical space, to be capitalized upon, they do require intellectual property protection. Working in an orphan disease area, we recognize that market forces act against us, and consequently, we recognize that patents may be dropped for financial reasons. Researchers may change course, and consequently, those research results may not be followed up on. We also ask for the right to step in and take over commercialization efforts on behalf of the institution in those cases where things don't reach the light of day for business reasons or scientific reasons. I would say that we have not had to undertake any of those sort of march-in efforts, and I don't look towards the day that we do, because I know it's going to be challenging to actually see something to through there. But what I would say is that we always wind up with those kinds of terms included in agreements, albeit after lengthy discussion. And then once we do reach reasonable terms, then we can repeatedly do agreements with groups. One of the last thing that we also see to is in the case of relocation, if an investigator relocates to a new institution, we want to ensure that his research, his or her research, is actually able to move with him, and so we actually include those kinds of terms in our agreements as a funder to see to the rights of the researcher.
Before we move to the next, just one second, before we move to another one of the panels, and you mentioned that your organization does basic science, translational work, clinical work. Your emphasis on these terms, I assume, is different depending on the type of research that you're funding.
Absolutely. So the case I described just now was really if we were sponsoring research at an academic institution.
Basic.
If it's basic research. If it's, and in fact, for translational research, by and large, those terms would be the same. But in the case that we're working on behalf of or with a for-profit firm or a major pharmaceutical company, we recognize, and so many of us in the organization actually come from pharma, we recognize that there are things that pharma has to have. They need to own their invention. They need to own the results of their invention. And they need not to be blocked. And so we actually advocate on behalf of that. If what I'll call, which is probably not the technical term, corollary inventions arise in the course of that, certainly those inventions are owned by the institution. But one shouldn't be able, in the course of conducting a clinical trial, to over-patent an individual's, a company's compound because you reverse engineered it and generated some sort of benefit from it. That actually typically takes care of itself. Those are, in fact, our negotiations with companies and on behalf of companies seem to have resolved themselves more quickly and more consistently over time. And part of that is actually due to the fact that as a group that has a clinical trials consortium, we now know each other's must-haves. And so therefore, we can very quickly reproduce what has worked in other cases, assuming that pharmaceutical companies believe us. That we're not trying to pull a fast one on them. For example, we actually entered into a clinical trials agreement with an extremely large pharmaceutical company in 3 weeks between ourselves, with ourselves as a party, three academic institutions, and that very, very, very large pharmaceutical company. So it actually can work.
Ed, do you have a question? Respond to that, or
add it all the way.
Well, I think that.
I mean, I can address the question.
Address the question. If you can if you want to.
Not preclude our investigators working with pharma. I think that if there's a word that could capture our general approach to these kinds of situations, it is that it is situational. And so, for example, there may be cases where we are supporting an academic investigator and we are aware that that investigator has figured a new assay. We are also working with a company that has proprietary compounds, and we'd really like to see what those compounds look like in that assay. The preferred relationship for us is that the industry partner works directly with the institution to work up an agreement whereby the investigator evaluates those compounds. So what happens is, though, we often end up helping the investigator who wants to do the study convince his tech transfer office that this is a good thing for the mission that everyone wants to do, and that it is not going to be inventive because it is evaluating a certain set of compounds, that ultimately there will be publications, but it might not be instantly, and that it's appropriate that the investigator not have reach-through rights to the material that he's about to receive or she's about to receive to evaluate. So that's one type of example. Another type of example is we often use our investigators that where we're funding research as consultants on some of these industry projects that we're working, because we want industry to have access to the best minds that we're aware of. And we run into problems sometimes with two scenarios. Either the investigator is approached by another party, and that investigator is supposed to disclose to us when that happens, and then they may be in conflict of interest with the company that we want them to help us with, and we may have to make a choice there. And so the other kind of thing that will happen is that quite often these investigators learn enough from being exposed to the drug discovery programs that they have an inventive idea and they want to launch their own drug discovery program within the confines of the institution. And then I need to make a judgment call on what point along that growth curve have they become a competitor for the company that we're using them to consult. So in each of these scenarios, it really depends. It depends on the situation. It depends on the actual product. It depends on the mechanism of action. And it depends on the institution's own goals and how collaborative they will be. And it depends on whether, foremost, I guess, it serves our intent to try to find a cure for CF. That if you try to have a rigorous conflict of interest policy and enforce it to the letter, you would wind up not being able to have any synergy going on amongst different investigators. That's what I'm thinking.
I mean, I think that begs the question of what you mean when you say a rigorous, a comprehensive conflict of interest policy. But, I mean, I think a conflict of interest, you like what she said, so... But, I mean, a conflict of interest policy is supposed to, in some ways, it's supposed to make people more aware of when they have potential conflicts and have a mechanism for, you know, bringing those to light and to, when it appropriate, have someone other than that person pass judgment or decide whether this person is too conflicted to resolve. Yeah.
I've found that some investigators really need reminder that they've signed CDAs, what confidentiality is, and, you know, what
is conflict of interest. No, I think that is exactly right, that people, and even just the notion of a conflict of interest, I'm not sure people always realize that they may not actually be, they may be operating in what any one of us would say is, you know, an appropriate way, that they don't seem to be conflicted by these different, but certainly from an outsider's perspective, there's a situation that could be considered, and they're oblivious to it. I think they need to know that. They need to know how their research might be criticized, even if they didn't have sort of any ill intent. Bob, were you?
Yeah.
spin on that? I mean, just to add to that, one way to possibly interpret what you're saying is that, do you take a stand in saying that it is in the interests of the cystic fibrosis community and the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation that inventions that may be relevant to cystic fibrosis research be done in the following way? I mean, in other words, is there a way, I don't know, Bob, I'm looking at you, whether that is a completely different question. Okay.
It's very interesting.
It's very interesting. Yeah. I think the other panel members should also contribute, but what I would say for us is that
this is probably reflective of a pattern on how we operate, is that we would not think to require that we be at the tables as a term and condition when we are funding something. But what happens because we are so well integrated with most of the discovery companies, and whether or not we're funding them, and most of the main players in the academic arena, quite often we get pulled in for advice on these kinds of issues. And then if we're welcomed to the negotiation, we can try to help make the point that, what are we all trying to do here? We're all trying to get to a stage where patients have a new drug that they can take to cure them. And so is this dilemma that you all are tussling about going to resolve, going to be positive towards that, or is it going to be a barrier? So I think there's been cases like the gene licensing where we weren't at the table, so to speak, originally, but we worked out a system with Michigan that helped recognize Michigan's rights and that enabled the field of discovery in CF to move forward. We took a sublicensable license from Michigan, and it got to the point, it is at the point now where basically when someone contacts Michigan and Toronto about a license to do screening, they send them to us because it's more convenient to have them all coming in through the same route. But it wasn't a requirement ever of the original work that we funded with Michigan. So I don't know if this is, what was yours?
Alan, did you?
Well, we would like to be invited, but we have no requirements in the funding to be invited. It has happened that the institutions that we fund have asked us to help work out some licensing agreement to bring in some additional expertise in that. So it wasn't at a national level, it was at the institutional level.
I would say for our part, again, we haven't been invited. I'm actually, I think it's quite to the credit of the CFF group that they were invited, because it's hard for me to imagine anyone who would actually ask an additional party to a licensing negotiation. So I think that's actually quite good. But what I would say is we, in order to try to bring groups together, recognizing that certainly cancer therapies are almost always used in combination, we host discussions of all manner to try to bring companies together with other key relevant stakeholders. For example, this summer here in Washington, we hosted an FDA roundtable with 18 companies represented ourselves and representatives from FDA in the room, including the pastor and some of his staff members. And what companies tell us is that we're viewed as the honest third-party broker. And I think where that comes into play is that when you actually start to talk about thorny issues in negotiations, like how do you bring two unproven medicines together into an early combination for early clinical testing, everyone turns to us and says, okay, how can you do that? And we don't actually have the answer, short of holding hands and singing Kumbaya. We would like to be able to do that. We will endeavor to try to do that. But I think that's where an advocacy group with some stature in the field can actually help to influence positively difficult decisions of the type you described.
Any other comments? Arvind?
I had a question.
Yes.
So about the marching rights, you mentioned that if the commercialization had first time the first would have stalled, you might be able to have the right to and take over the commercialization. I was just kind of curious how that would work, how that does work, given that the nonprofit foundation and the university has a technology licensing apparatus that presumably has an expertise in this or capability. How would you be able to commercialize the prevention of the
Well, that actually is the way the discussion usually goes when we have this negotiation. Why would you think you would be able to do it when we haven't been able to? And we say, that's fine. Maybe we will fail as well, but we think it may be driven by market forces and that through our network of connections, we may be able to find a home for it. If we do, the benefits still accrue to the university. We take only a marginal increase in our benefits on that basis. So it's not as though we're ever trying to take anything away from the institution or the inventors. We're just trying to be sure that we advance the technology as appropriate patients.
Anyone else want to comment on that? Or
I wanted to come back to respond to a question of yours, Ed, and pertaining to the conflict between industry, nonprofits, and research. We have been approached by one or two pharmas that wanted us to be effectively a grants administration, serve that function. We would get a little bit, and we talked it around internally, and I made some calls to sister organizations, and a number of them did do that kind of work. And there's an advantage to the pharmaceutical in that they have budgets from different pots, and this one's more discretionary, and if they know the person in this foundation, they can get it to a particular researcher very quickly. We chose to decline those offers. We felt that it did. Well, they had a particular project in mind, so it wasn't a grant to us with no strings attached. So they had a particular. Well.
A what? They had a laundry.
Well, a grants administrator.
You mean to hide the true source of the funding?
Well,
is that what you're suggesting?
We had a more beneficial overhead rate with that particular group. So you could argue, so we felt that we had to think about it because we would be getting more money to the researcher. But then we talked it around and realized that we really would lose our status as we, we're just trying to make the thing work.
So this is an interesting direction that we've taken here, and I don't want to lose it, and I thought maybe we would sort of jump from the first question we started, which I think only one of you got to answer, to the discussion we had on the phone about how your institutions sometimes are playing two roles, or could find yourself on the one hand wanting to assure that the results of research that you fund are available to others who are working in the fields of your interest, and at the same time, you mentioned Louise, wanting to protect, file a patent or otherwise protect the intellectual property. Each of you mentioned when we spoke last week about taking some interest in royalty streams and and in some cases, I think perhaps in your case, Alan, even controlling the IP that comes. So how, with that sort of conflict, I suppose, or potential conflict, and then going back to Bob's point about when you're involved, you certainly have a key constituency in mind. You have an outcome in mind that the university may share, but they may not share in a particular case. I mean, they may share it in a general sense, a grand sense, but in a particular, for a particular invention, it may be that going to pharmaceutical company A is the right way for them to do it, but that may not be the right way for your constituency, or vice versa. So how do you, I mean, do you, in what situations, I guess, are you not going to be able to play the role that Bob is suggesting, or would you might find yourself at odds with your, do you find yourself at odds sometimes with your own desire that this information or this material, these tools, be widely made widely available because of some, you know, you mentioned, for example, the having relationships with a collaborative pharmaceutical company and hiring an investigator to be a consultant until such time as that investigator's research starts to be too competitive with that, with what your project, your funding with the pharmaceutical company. So these are all potential conflicts where, you know, it might really help things in the end if this investigator knows what the pharmaceutical company's doing. Of course, the pharmaceutical company doesn't want to be sharing, and, you know, and vice versa. So how do you balance that? I mean, does this come up this often, I guess?
It comes up all the time.
How much are we part of the problem, I guess? The people who fund and find themselves unable to get access to the materials may also be people who are imposing terms sometimes that make it difficult for other people to get access to materials, I guess is what I'm suggesting.
I don't know if I can think of an example where that is I don't know that I can think of an academic example where our terms were the problem in a successful outcome. I mean, certainly there's been industry-to-industry situations where there's been an acquisition of a company by a company where we had rights to a product that we had funded. That acquisition was dependent on us altering our rights to enable it to go through. And, you know, what typically happens is if we think that the best thing, the way to increase the chances of that product making it to the patient is for us to relax our original requirement, then we do it. Because we're not in the business to try to keep intellectual property or, I mean, we put return on investment into our contracts, but not because that's our business, getting a return on investment, rather because it's a useful vehicle for helping make sure these products actually make it all the way to the end if they change ownership along the way. And so, I think I could give an example where, I mean, the typical lifetime of a new project with industry, where we're bringing in expertise because we know who the players are, and we want the company to have access to all of the best cystic fibrosis research minds. There's this active project management role we play, and I do some of these myself. And so for the first year, what you're doing is you're training the company to see these people as contributors and not as
competitors.
People who will report to us. They're in a passive
way. Oh,
whether
I see.
Or not the company is doing the right thing. So there's a show and tell thing in the beginning of the meetings where they show, you know, sanitized versions of their results, and then the advisors say, well, we want more data. And then during that period of time, there's a trust that's eventually built up. First of all, there's trust that the advisors will honor their confidentiality. And then there's trust that the advisors really want to help them succeed, and that the advisors might have good suggestions to make, and they need information, they need data in order to make those.
Just to be clear, the advisors you're referring to are the people you've brought in from the academic community that you've identified as experts in the field. So they're advising the company. Okay.
Then there comes a point where sometimes the advisors think of a thing they could do that would be a new project for them that would directly help the project. And there's been occasions where we took them off the advisory team as a direct advisor, and we released them so that they could have a direct relationship with the company.
To engage in whatever that project might
search in a way where there isn't a conflict of interest.
Yeah, at that point, they couldn't objectively advise on whether that particular part of the it was worth doing because they're doing it, so, right.
There's other times when I've had to say to an advisor after they don't come and they'll say, you know, my research is going in the following direction, and I'll have to have this conversation with them where I say, I'm not sure you can stay on the team because if I tell the company this is what you plan to do with your research, they're going to immediately see it as competition. They're going to have a hard time. So we'll come to an agreement where sometimes I use a vehicle where we make it an auxiliary, sort of an ad hoc advisor on an ad-needed basis.
On a particular issue or a particular aspect of a project.
So, and then I disclose to the company that this advisor is not going to be on the team anymore because we had a conversation about where they plan to go with their research and we felt that it was going to bring them into a conflict of interest situation. And sometimes those relationships that have been developed between the company and the advisor still continue in an informal manner after the fact because after all, we're trying to recruit everybody to the cause that we want. We want everybody to stop and think, is what I'm doing going to serve the patients, even the industry people, and they do get there.
But, and I want to ask a question, and it's only partially supposed to be humorous, and that is how many lawyers are involved in this process? And the reason I say that, though, is it sounds to me as though you, as a project manager and as a scientist, and as someone who has been involved in working on, you know, with academic scientists and company scientists, have figured out what you think is a conflict, and you do have agreements. You mentioned you had, you know, CDAs, but are there lawyers involved when you set one of these things up, or do you have a pattern? Do you have some pretty well honed forms that work, and you don't.
So we have sort of standard agreements that I wouldn't go so far as to say are templates because there's always something you need to bother with. But we don't change the general language of these kinds of agreements in any substantive way without getting our general counsel to look at it and to have a conversation. So we have a general counsel who isn't in our employ. And I also have an intellectual property specialist who's a lawyer that I just hired about 6 months ago. I think that there's a huge learning curve for a new counsel, actually.
A new what?
Counsel.
Right. To know how to step back.
And to understand why we're breaking all the rules.
Right.
You know, when we've got a certain file open. And so you kind of have to say, well, here's some history to it, and here's the context that it fits in, and here's the particular situation, and here's the goal.
Well, but that actually ties in with something I've said for a long time, is that a lawyer needs a client. That, you know, if you put a lawyer in charge of something, the lawyer's going to find everything that could go wrong, and they're going to, yeah, and if you, but you know what you want to do, and so you mentioned training the lawyer, and that's possible, and that's appropriate, and it's what you should do, which is they should give you advice, and you should make a decision about whether you're going to worry about that in a particular case. And you're so astounded that a lawyer could do that.
It's fun. I'm not astounded.
Does anyone else want to comment on this this conflict, this potential conflict you, your organizations might find yourself in, and how you address that?
Well, I was going to answer the question about how many lawyers are involved.
Oh, sure. We'll go. No, you can do that one too.
We're very thin on the lawyers. Our work is done pro bono, and they have a personal interest in the disease, and I think that I'd like to get your others on the panel if they find that they're getting this tremendous level of expertise that comes in on a spot basis because they want this thing figured out too. So it's we've had tremendous help being in Silicon Valley, and we have quite an infrastructure of everything you'd want to make an invention commercialized and get to the patient. And this is just another area where we don't need to have, I don't know if you pay your lawyers, but ours are, they come in when we need them. I mean, they don't make it a top priority if they have an emergency, but they're there.
Yeah, we pay our lawyers. I actually wanted to make a comment because I think it relates to something that you raised earlier, Ed. And it also relates to time. I can think of an example that is in fact actually happening right now, where we are attempting to broker a series of tests to be done by academic researchers on a drug that we think is of particular interest, and the researchers think it's of particular interest, but the pharmaceutical company who has the drug and who owns the drug wants to delay publications for 18 months after the completion of the research work. And probably we think that 12 months would be something that the academic centers might live with, but I can tell you that 6 months have gone by in the negotiation. So if we'd agreed to 18 months 6 months ago, it would be done. And I really don't think that these publications are going to change the world. And so why are we fighting over the issue of academic freedom for publication when it's really not going to change the world? And does it really matter if you wait 6 months? Now, granted, 5 years, okay, that's an extreme, but there must be some room for discussion in there and not umbrage. And I would love to hear some cogent discussion and reality on those kinds of points.
Have the lawyers be working for without pay, and it might go fast.
Actually, may be true. Yeah, sure, David.
Pharmaceutical company feels that way. I mean, clearly the pharmaceutical company feels that way. Now, are they the extreme? Yes.
Feels which way? I'm sorry.
The pharmaceutical company feels that they should
postpone.
Be able to postpone.
Right.
Because, and why is it in their interest to do so? It's in their interest, as someone who used to work for this very same company, it's in their interest to do so because they want to time their publication so they get the most bang for the buck out of when the disclosures take place. Well, and of course that happens, but if you step back and think about other core values, my core values in this particular case are in the patient interest. And this delay is delaying, potentially, the start of a clinical trial of an important new entity for the disease because the core values collide. Now, I'm not saying what's right or what's wrong. I'm saying what ruffles my feathers. And I wonder that purity of publication is so important that a delay of a clinical trial that could help patients who are dying isn't more important. That's the part that causes me some concern.
So the corporation can help my culture. This is only one of you guys.
And indeed, we have had those discussions. They have compromised significantly, but they feel that this is their lie. Now, is there room for further negotiation? Possibly. Or perhaps not.
Thank you.
say a few things. Actually, I go through this kind of discussion with every new partner that we ever have a relationship with. And
say a new partner. Who are we referring to? A university partner? A company? Okay.
Yeah. So the university partners are usually pretty appreciative of the standard terms and conditions. And we have more of a difficulty with universities on sort of making a distinction between what is a result that must be patented and must be protected, and making sure that they're dogging those, and then those inventions that are really only going to ever make a difference in the world if they are disseminated publicly as soon as possible.
How do you know which is which from at the outset?
I said it's difficult. So we, you know, what we do in general is say we require reporting of invention disclosures, and we occasionally will agree to support the money for the patent applications if it's an out-of-cycle grant with a specific goal in mind, specific goals that we want, that we think lead directly to something that needs to be patented. Otherwise, we just take the opportunity to assume an abandoned patent or assume a patent so it won't be abandoned by the university if they stop. But a lot of times stuff just gets out into the public domain before there's ever an invention disclosure. And that's when there's an education opportunity for the investigators to say,
so nice,
you know, you're not going to find an industry partner to bring this compound forward because they don't have any guarantee that their competitors are doing the same thing that we published. But on the industry side, when to come back to your question, when we're talking about sort of, I get this argument all the time, well, so you said you were a nonprofit and you needed all these special terms, and now you're acting like a business because you're looking for a good return on your investment. And I say, yes, I absolutely do both things. And the reason that we do it is because we believe that if we aren't negotiating a good return on investment as in a major investment, then we have no leverage if something goes south with the project to attract another partner. So would we like to have a return on investment that's actual money in our pockets to offset some of our revenue needs? Absolutely. Have we ever been successful? This helps to explain to people too. Have we ever been successful? Once. So far, in all the history of all the hundreds of millions of dollars that this foundation has spent, there's been one compound make it to market where we had a revenue stream attached to it. And what did we do with it? We sold it to the company before it actually started generating revenue. We monetized it early because we didn't want to be in a position of promoting, taking the drug if we were getting a revenue stream from the drug. And so I usually tell people when I'm negotiating an industry contract up front that is the likely thing that will happen, but I won't promise it, and I won't necessarily give them a first right of refusal either. So this is a really interesting year because the economy is tanking in a really big way. We've just slashed our budget by $10 million, and we're looking at what if we need to slash it by another $10 million in 2009, what are we going to do? Our budget for the CFFT side of things is, last year was $102 million. So that includes funding academic-sponsored clinical trials as well as the drug discovery program. So what it doesn't include is the general spending at CF centers so that there will be a CF center at 120 different hospitals around the country. I think that so we are asking ourselves, we're always coming to the same conclusion, but we keep asking ourselves, should we be paying more attention to generating revenue? Because we anticipate a really poor fundraising. We don't have an endowment. We spend money to raise every year. And we've been successful, but next year's going to be bad. So will we need to change? I'm not saying I have the answer. I'm just saying we're questioning our own strategies right now about how hard do we chase the revenue. Bucking for $25 checks at the annual spring walk. Also, we don't get industrial gifts. We have, companies sometimes give us a check towards great strides as part of that campaign. Many companies send a team of 100 people out walking. I mean, Vertex does that. So the other way we get money is major donors, one-time only gifts. So we have a group that tries to find people with a reason to want to support cystic fibrosis who have a lot of money and try to get $1 million or more out of them. So those are the two major sources for it.
We get industry funding, but we divert it to our patient education program. And it comes in the form, and it's like a line at the bottom of one page of a 20-page booklet on how to manage your glaucoma. So it's not a, you know, it's not an advertisement, but so that's how we handle that.
Can I, Ed, before we go on? Well, you have one more follow-up on that? Sure. That's actually where I was going as well. So, and I don't know whether that's the same for the other two of you, but I'd be interested to hear the answer to that. And it's something that is actually referred to in the questions in our materials here. How a company had said that, success rate is extremely low. Success measured by something of some economic value coming out of a sponsored project. An economist would probably tell you not to spend much time, you know, thinking about your revenue side, or at least you need to look at what you're funding, because it doesn't seem to be turning out a lot of big hits from a revenue standpoint.
Successes.
Are there other reasons then to spend what? What is the effort in having these agreements? What is that bringing you? It's not bringing you revenue. Have you found that the agreements themselves have been useful to you in directing? Are there other reasons to engage in these negotiations with universities, or should you just be given the money and on a more university friendly basis? I guess is the.
I'll comment on that first. I would disagree with the idea that the money should just be given without any consideration to protecting the intellectual property, for the very simple reason that if it's not, we do very early work, if it's not protected from the start, then it's never going to get any further along with the clinical trials eventually.
But what if you believe that they actually have an interest, the same interest you do in protecting it? I mean, is that not the case? I mean, that the universities won't protect it unless you step in and
we would like to be sure about it, really. And then we don't find it too onerous date.
I mean, I would just say we have similar terms by way of asking for a return on investment. It usually is capped as some fold over the initial investment that we make in the work. And so it's not terribly onerous. It's not reached through royalties. It's not going to dilute the downstream value of any of the products in any significant way. And we have not recognized any revenue on that basis. I'll give up ours, and the technology transfer offices that haven't earned any significant funds give up theirs. Because I think when you look at the actual return on investment from all of the activities that have taken place on the university side, there's a likewise very low return rate. So
I think that's one of the things that this committee is thinking about. Well, what is the purpose of the tech transfer office? What is the purpose of, what are the goals and motivations for incurring those costs? Yes, Martin.
If I rephrase the question, what are the situations, are there characteristics of institutions within the situations are more difficult in terms of negotiating
the
intellectual property rights?
Or the case-by-case factors?
I mean,
amount of money, other money the researcher's giving as an institution?
It's, as Diana described, it's situational. If it's a sort of big brand name institution where they think they're bigger and can play more hardball, that can make it harder, but once we get to a place, we usually stay there. If it's clearly drug-related, if we're really talking about something that's going to be a small molecule that develops from it, that means it's a different discussion. And that's probably appropriate because that's where the lottery ticket really has some potential value. Are there other characteristics? And it tends to all devolve around what is the reality of there actually being, of a revenue-generating invention actually evolving from the work. And that's fair. I think that's completely fair. I only invoke the researchers when the discussions have gone too long and we're at risk of pulling the money back because we've spent tens of thousands of dollars on legal fees, and that's just not a good use of our donor funds.
And what is the rough, is there an average size of what of funding, project funding that we're talking about here? I mean, if you spend tens of thousands of dollars on it, I mean, are you putting in $500,000 or?
So our individual grants to research fellows, which are the junior awards, are $75,000 for 1 year. So I could spend $10,000 negotiating a fellows award,
wow.
$75,000 or. Yes. And then our senior investigator awards are $200,000 for 2 years. So a total award of $200,000, and I could spend $10,000 negotiating one of those easily. I've spent more. And I've gone to bat for the investigator and the institution. Sometimes wish I hadn't.
Let's get the answers from the other two panels to this question that Arvitz asks. Do you want to repeat, or do you?
What factors are affecting your ability to negotiate funding rights and institutions?
We're involved in early stage work, and we, on our longer term, bigger program, we are assembling people that haven't been in the field before. We're pulling in from the other neurodegenerative diseases, so. Again, there's no value, so you can put a lot of stuff out there and they'll say, great, I'd love to jump in. So we have a situation that's different from, you know, the groups to my left and right who have longer standing agreements. They have much more, it sounds like, industry input on the funding. So we really have a privileged spot where we can just allow it. It just basically goes through. I mean, I'm not saying there's not snags, but since it's so early, people just want to start doing the work, so they're very motivated to get going.
Yeah.
Funding that goes out that is a direct support of a given industry project is from this team. That's not the usual driver. So we have a large range of awards. They could be $10,000 for a piece of equipment. Discovery work in an academic setting that can be tens of millions of dollars over a period of several years. But those are rare, the high-end ones. So it's not unusual for us to be doing out-of-cycle support in the several hundred thousand dollar categories. And so what's in our way of negotiating control of intellectual property? We don't ask for control of intellectual property. What we ask for is to be kept in the loop, to be informed that there is property activity going on. And to be honest, one of our biggest problems with respect to this category of question is compliance. The investigators themselves don't always put in invention disclosures. If they do, their institution, it's a rare institution that tells us they've done that. So we might find out about it. We might see a paper come up and we'll phone up the investigator and say, great result. You know, did you put in an invention disclosure before you put that out there? And then the other thing is that if we ever do want to figure out, if we are aware that a university is negotiating rights to an invention that we funded, then it's often extremely difficult to figure out how much of our money, like what was our contribution to the invention, because the investigator rarely keeps good records as to, you know, how many other, they just put every grant they have on their publication. And so it's a mess to go in there later and figure out, you know, did we fund 10% of that invention? Did we fund, you could say we funded 100% since that's exactly what the grant application was for.
Right.
So I don't think it's so much gaining control as it is ensuring that what's put in place around it
second, which is when you going back, Diana, to you're saying that there's been one sort of, you know, revenue generating thing over the, I wonder, do you think that, the reason that there's only been one relates to what you just said? I mean, are there cases where there might have been revenue for you, but you didn't find out about the invention until too late, or it didn't get protected, or are you aware of
that there should be revenue coming to us? And I have initiated an audit for those 2 instances, and we're having being ignored by one institution, and the other institution has thrown up so many blocks that they basically said, well, the investigator never tells us anything, so why don't you go and go ahead and ask them? And so we're stuck with not quite sure how much time and money to invest in this, but we're pretty sure that there should be some infusion of money coming in 2009 that we could really use. So
then the other question I wanted to ask that I think it's worth getting out there is, when we're talking about your negotiating with someone at the university about these agreements or about the sponsorship, or I guess on the other side, you're involved maybe as the university is licensing out something that, may have resulted from research that you funded. Who are you dealing with at the university? Is that part of an issue as well? I mean, so a lot of universities have their sponsored projects office, their sponsored research office, then they have a separate technology transfer, technology licensing, somebody referred to it, office. Do you have any, you know, wisdom for us in terms of, does it work better when they're combined? Does it work better when they're not combined? Is it just, are there any rules of thumb? Well, a painful experience maybe, isn't it? Yes.
Sure.
Wants to answer right next to
you. You should say your affiliation.
Yes.
I guess I... Well, if I, if I could just, our particular mission is to urgently and aggressively find treatments for multiple myeloma. And funding basic research, frankly, is a long-term bet that may never pay off in the 95% case. And yet, in those situations in which there is an invention that may be an antibody or a small molecule, some other sort of peptide. Those are the situations in which one wants to ensure that intellectual property is taken when it's appropriate to protect it so that it can be commercialized. And moreover, given the market disadvantage that an orphan disease faces, like multiple myeloma, academic institutions or even for-profit companies may choose not to keep that patent active in their stable of patents. And in those situations, we request the opportunity to continue to defend the patent and to find a commercialization partner. And it's for those, and since you really, it's very difficult to predict which bets are going to pay off. Moreover, in the interest of financial, using our financial resources wisely, we would prefer to negotiate one agreement with an institution and use that agreement repeatedly, which is why I spend $10,000 on a $75,000 fellow agreement, because I know when I go back to brand name institution, they're going to say, but you agreed to these terms before. Well, yes, and they're the best terms I know I can get with you, and I'm happy to use those repeatedly. So I think it's conserving all of those resources collectively. That's why we undertake the way things the way we do.
I'm going to call on this gentleman over here who's had his hand up for quite a while. Yeah.
It's a big issue. 10%.
0%.
It says, I'm not sure I'm allowed to say because it's not my department. I'm sorry. I don't want to say a percent, but it's in her neighborhood. Yes. Not on agreed terms. There are institutions that we do not fund research in because we cannot come to agreement on the terms. So, but let me give the gentleman over here one concrete example that may help answer your question.
Sure, absolutely.
Now, why do we bother? I've got 1,000 things to do. The last thing I really need to be doing is arguing with someone over the terms and conditions of intellectual property that may or may not ever come into existence. But I do it because it fits with the larger strategy. And I can give you an example of a situation where there might be something that could ultimately actually be a significant drug for the patients that would never see the light of day if the following scenario happens. So we're sponsoring a research program in an academic institution. There's terms and conditions in place. There's a requirement that there be disclosure when there's an invention, that the university appropriately support the invention, and that if the university chooses not to, that we have the opportunity to do that. The investigator sets up a new assay, screens some compounds that they get from NIH, or perhaps ordered from Cambridge, and discovers some really interesting molecules that have a unique mechanism. scientific gathering and put a poster on it on which they reveal the structure of the molecule. And everybody and their dog with a camera takes who's interested in that disease area takes a picture of the poster. And now the institution thinks, well, oh, this is interesting. We should probably try and find a place to license this technology. Not an academic or not an industry, small or large, would touch that all through the 10-foot hole. So now this molecule, we give the investigator some more money, and it turns out that the thing has some PK problems, or maybe, you know, it's not very bioavailable. But the institution, or that the investigator sort of poisoned the ability to protect around that, because there's so many obvious things you can do to the molecule to try and cure that problem. So you're left with either a foundation like ours, or the university out of its own coffers would have to come up with hundreds of thousands of dollars to bring that molecule through medicinal chemistry and through the clinic. Even in a situation where you were lucky enough to come up with a compound that could make it as a development candidate, you still have to figure out how you're going to formulate it. You have to outsource the manufacture. You have to do all the tox studies. If the industry isn't picking it up and doing that, that compound becomes a tool compound forever. It never is developed into a drug, and that's a huge opportunity lost, because had the intellectual property been in place and a license successfully issued to a small biotech company, they would have advanced it, and it would have succeeded or failed on its own merit, but there would have been the ability to have a revenue stream for the licensor that would make it worth their while to take their assets of their people and the time and their knowledge to try to get it through the clinic. So that's why it's so important that intellectual property be covered.
I concur with Diana. She gave a great example. I used to do venture capital work, and I vetted, sourced, and did due diligence on a lot of things in the life science world. And it didn't go any further if there were no patents or there were lousy patents. We just let it go. I don't think they're stupid. I think that they're not trained in certain dimensions. And just being able to do good lab notebooks, for example, or knowing that before you put in even an abstract or a talk, you've queried the deal.
So I want to go back to the fact there's a gentleman back here that's waving his hand, Frank.
Yeah, so just to respond,
people at panels this morning saying, well, you know, these tech transfer offices are patenting everything. They should be patenting as much as they're patenting. But the sort of gist of what you were saying is that, I'm sure you don't mean it, but that what I've been picking up is that you really want to make sure that things that should be patented, I guess, are patented. And so the question is, what things shouldn't be patented? And okay, you've got to...
Actually, yes, we're setting up a biomarker consortium, and the terms and conditions of participation for both industry and academia is going to be, it all goes into the public domain. And I'll tell you, we're not the only ones thinking that. GSK has taken that position publicly. They're a member of the NIH biomarker consortium and several other large companies. That basically, why? Because we won't be able to use them in time to help us if they are broadly used, broadly characterized, and broadly accessible.
Broadly accepted.
And you wanted to add to the question, the answer?
Yeah.
Let me just ask this gentleman over here. So, John?
We have that in our standard agreements, and I think Diana said that they do too, but that it doesn't always, doesn't mean that they'll do it.
And we have it in our agreements as well, both not only to see the publications for the purpose of identifying patentable information, and I've never seen a publication in advance, which means that, and I think this is to the point, folks are plenty happy to accept the funds, but they're not plenty happy to abide by the terms.
And it goes back to the point
that penalty for them not.
And there doesn't seem to be.
But I mean that would come back to you guys. I mean, if you keep giving money but you don't enforce the agreements, what is the message there? And I'm not trying to lay it. I'm just saying that you either care about it or you don't care about it. And yes, over here. just ask a quick follow-up. Did you say that you do get papers submitted to you?
Yes.
And why is that?
I would bet you're a bigger organization than we are.
Well, I mean, we've heard most people say, and I've heard lots of companies say, that they never hear anything when they've got a requirement that somebody submit a paper to them in advance of a publication. And so you seem to have a different experience, and I'm just curious why you think that is. You're very close. It's a sort of a continuous or nearly continuous back and forth. We've got Wes, did you? Was there a question there, Wes?
Yeah.
Or? That's good.
Well, at the risk of being somewhat inflammatory, let me turn the question around. As academic researchers, how would you like that enforcement to take place? Because clearly it's not happening. Clearly it's not all that onerous. But do you want someone looking over your shoulder and saying, shame on you? How would you like that discussion to take place?
Well, and let me just, I guess, add, I said, you know, something like shame on you a minute ago for not enforcing, but that there is a point here of not asking for things that you really don't expect them to perform on, or that you don't expect to enforce if they don't perform, because the more things that are in an agreement at the outset, the more reasons there are for people to get, you know, all tied up and decide, well, you're, you know, if you want me to submit a paper to you and hold, you get 90 days. I mean, if you've never gotten a paper under any of the agreements that you've ever, why ask? I mean, and the reason you would, for somebody there not to ask, of course, would seem like heresy not to ask for that, but why ask?
I know Arvis wants to make a comment. I'll say in our case, and I would say this is important to a lot of foundations, we would actually like to know that we're acknowledged for the funding, more so than examine it for intellectual property. That would come, of course.
But the
acknowledgments are not.
Is there a better way to get that? I guess is one. You know,
I'm open to that as well.
Woods.
Frustration over the lack of disclosure or inventions that don't need IP to push them along and commercialize them. So you're frustrated about this happening to the inventions in your fund, but surely this is a much more general problem for the university, irrespective of who's funding. So I was just curious, maybe from the university side, how big of a problem that they see this is, and how do they manage it? So maybe Kathy or Dana can speak to that. I mean,
while they're thinking, we've got someone who's going to jump out of his chair. Before you ask, yeah, please go ahead.
Do you folks have an association? You know, a lot of this association. I have my time for the campus. Do you folks have an association for
funders of research?
No, there isn't one. Yeah. There isn't one.
The three charter members are sitting here, maybe.
Sounds good, but I think that you could contrast what Alan said and what I've said about our different institutions' policies, and that we have, I think, developed policies that work for our disease, and it depends on the particulars of the disease, how many patients are involved, you know, how well developed are the targets. And so what works for him, he wants the intellectual property directly. We don't. We don't think it works for us. So I don't think that we should force him to adopt our policy and vice versa. So I don't know if blanket policies like that would really be practical.
Before we go, I just want to do a little quick clock check. I think when you introduced it, you said 1:30 to 3, but the other 30 minutes are also for this as well. So, okay, open. So we, back in the back, one of our panel members. Okay. Thank you. Here and then there. Okay, right here and then over there.
Doing the charging. It's the companies that are doing the charging, but the answer is
we've got an answer from a pharmaceutical over here. Pharmaceutical.
you should check out Genzyme's business model. They focus on orphan drugs.
I have a question here, or did it get answered? Yeah.
So I just mentioned some of the work by Janet Berkowitz and Tyler. So they looked at a bunch of research agreements. They had a sample about 136. And offline, I can give more details. Basically, they looked at a lot of the provisions that are in the agreements. And these are industry-sponsored research. And the types of provisions that are in there, how prevalent they are, those types of things. So we talked about IP control. So what are the different aspects of do they contain options for letter of first refusal for a license? Do they contain any pre-negotiated parameters any license would contain? Is there sub-licensing, things like that? So they've kind of looked at those types of things and have some data on how prevalent these different types of terms are in these contracts. Now, the purpose of their study was not really to look at why, when those things are in there, other than they're really kind of looking at a different type of research question related to what we've been talking about today. That's not the purpose of their study. They're looking at the sponsored research agreements to really kind of look at the development of capabilities by these industrial partners to contract. So I can help with that. But anyway, my stuff, I am still collecting data from the Michigan sponsored research agreements. They've generously given me access to anything I want there. And I just, of course, don't have anything to any data or any summary statistics I can have to share today. So I've done more. I mentioned MTAs.
Question down in front here. And I wonder if that doesn't tie into something that was said earlier, and I'm not sure that it was ever quite addressed, is what role funders, whether it be NIH or whether it be foundations that fund particular, might have in helping raise standards or raise the knowledge about what ought to be patented, what shouldn't be patented, best practices, which is a term that I shouldn't use because I don't know what it is, but things that making people more aware. But whether it's the investigator and the postdocs and the students, or even the tech transfer people, the university administrators.
spend your precious time patenting those things that need to be patented, or they will never service the public, which is what your mission is. And quickly determine not to patent those things that could enable, and that's where they should be. So
you, the inventor, do no harm in terms of going either way. Don't go disclosing things in a public disclosure.
Have a conversation,
right,
basically,
beforehand.
And we would love to give our two cents. Require that everybody do what we want, but we would love there to be more discussion and to have a chance to consider whether, you patenting this particular plasmid when it has no special application is really what you want to do with your time. And, it comes back later to be a problem for people actually making use of someone's inventive moment.
Somebody interested, or a commercial company interested in the technology, and then they'll have them pay for it. And so that really kind of, interest by demand by industry for these inventions has a lot to say about whether or not they can happen. One study that I'm aware of, in a way, that's kind of
yeah.
Okay. So you said it's like 2 seconds. Okay. And then I'm going to take the last 10 seconds to sum all of this up into a really neat. It's time to. Okay. Well, unfortunately, Mark says I can't. I guess if I. My observation is sort of like the things you learn in kindergarten approach, which is that probably one size doesn't fit all, but it does sound like that being clear about what you're trying to accomplish, having people know a little more about. What's involved when they're making a decision one way or the other. All these things sound like they would be good things for us to do. And I don't think I can come up with anything more than that at this point. But I do think these kinds of forums are good opportunities to think about these things. I want to thank my panelists for doing a great job.